Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics, the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute also offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is The Police as Public Servants, and today's guest is Police Chief Burbank. Chief Burbank has been with the Salt Lake Police Department since 1991. He was appointed to the position of Chief of Police in March of 2006. He became the 45th Chief of the department. During Chief Burbank's tenure, Salt Lake City has received extensive attention for several high-profile incidents. Chief Burbank has been an outspoken opponent of the cross-deputization of police officers as immigration enforcement agents. He has participated in several national conferences regarding the issues and spoke at U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division 2009 Title VI Conference. Chief Burbank received special recognition from the American Civil Liberties Union of Utah for working in protecting immigration civil rights in May of 2009. Also in June of that year, he was recognized by the Latino Community Center for his dedication to community policing in building and maintaining a great foundation with the Latino community. Chief Burbank was appointed a venue commander during the 2002 Winter Olympic Games, responsible for planning, organizing, and implementing security for the downtown Olympic Square, employing over 1,000 federal, state, and local law enforcement officers and troops from the Utah National Guard. Chief Burbank has a Bachelor of Science degree in Sociology from the University of Utah and is a graduate of the FBI's National Executive Institute. Prior to his service in the police department, he was a professional squash player, achieving a number 38 ranking in the world. He is married and has 3 children. So let's welcome our guest, Chief Burbank.
I need to get you a shortened version of that, absolutely. Thank you very much. I'm a very informal speaker, and so I would much prefer to let you kind of guide the direction that we go today as opposed to me to stand up and talk. You'll see that I'm not very shy, and so I'm not afraid to talk about issues and those types of things. So please don't hesitate to ask or disagree with me on certain issues, because that's part of the reason that I like to come up to the university so much, is because of the dialogue and discussion. It
really Skyfall.
That we look at issues and say, okay, how can we impact them? And my role, I am the vice president of the Major City Chiefs Association, which is the 70 largest police agencies in the United States and Canada. And the tenure for those police chiefs is about 2.5 years. And so there's a lot of turnover that takes place. But I have always felt that it's important that in policing that we stand up and we say, this is what we're willing to do. Because as you look back through history, right, police officers have often been a very effective arm of oppression. And that's not a light statement. But you consider some of the laws, some of the bias that has been interjected into our society over the years. And it is often police officers, because we stand as a ready force. And I have 450 officers in Salt Lake City alone. And then you look across the country, I mean, there's a significant number. And so as laws are enacted and put into place, who else is going to follow through with those types of things than the police? Very difficult to activate the military or the National Guard, but the police are already stand up ready to go. And that is, in fact, our role, is to do enforcement action. And so, again, it's contingent upon policing to stand up and say, this is what's best for our profession. Right? I think we have moved, as a profession, from once what was a strictly blue-collar environment. In fact, if you look at me, and my executive officer should be walking in the door any minute now, and Fred, and he's about my same height, same build. Right? And most of the questions when I hired on 22 years ago were, how can you handle yourself in a stressful situation? You know, have you ever been in a fight before? And there was no question that my size played into hiring me. And this was a short time ago, 20 years ago. Policing at the time, we hired a few females because we kind of had to. And it really wasn't viewed as a profession for people of intellect. right? People who wanted to do something more with their life. It was viewed pretty much as, I don't want to say lower class, but you look back, especially traditionally, right? Why are there so many Irish policemen across the country? Because at the time when the Irish were vilified in our country, that's about the only job they could get was policing. And so it's an interesting profession that has now really made the change in the step forward, I think, in life. And it's fun to see and to be involved in part of that. As I said before, it used to be that we hired officers really for their strength, their size, and can you handle yourself in a fight? Because this is some serious business we're going to go out. Right? We strap guns on our hips, and there's a reason that we do that, because we want everyone to know that we have a firearm and we can use it. Right? It's a very overt type of action. The uniform, everything that goes along with it is, I am here, right, and I'm in charge. And for the most part, we get a little bit of that from society. Something changed, though, in the early mid-90s. We had a lot of kind of scandals that occurred in the country, Rodney King being one of those in Los Angeles. I always have to be careful because I'm getting old now. Who knows Rodney King Institute? We'll go to the back of the room. I'm not saying, no comment, but please, give us a thumbnail of the Rodney King incident in Los Angeles.
Cell phone video, or just camcorder video, got popular when they started coming down in price, and people did a videotape of the police trying to stop and make an arrest, and it got a bit out of hand. Not knowing...
Well, you are very generous with that.
Well, it was more than out of hand.
Okay.
It was. It had crossed some serious lines, brought up issues of racism, the riots in the urban areas that followed that after the civil lawsuit came out in favor of the police officers. I've often wondered if people would have had the support for that had they known his background at the time the video released. But it was the police had overstepped their bounds. They used excessive force and authority in trying to make a traffic stop.
Let me be right up front. They overstepped. There is no question about that.
Chief, can I just add?
Oh, please.
I was there on University of Utah business. In 1992, April 29th. And I'll always remember Southern California with orange, a sky of orange and black, and a state of emergency declared. You had to be off the streets by 7 o'clock at night. And I was able to drive from Pasadena to Santa Monica in 35 minutes. Never saw a police car. You know,
they were occupied. No,
they were otherwise occupied.
So the reason for the stop, right? Motorist refused to stop for the police, so it becomes a high-speed chase. They chase him for quite a while. High hazard thing. And in those days, police agencies across the country basically chased cars till the wheels came off. Right? That was part of the thing. And in fact, we in society loved it because we put it on TV all the time and it ran live most of the time. And we showed pursuits and chases all over the country and it was very exciting. And so we fueled that. Said, yeah, we kind of enjoy this. This is fun TV. And anyway, it eventually stops. The officers get out of the car. Mr. King, an African-American male, refuses to comply with their direction. So at the time, a taser was used on him. Not as effective as, especially not kind of modern things. This was first generation sort of thing. And he failed to comply. And so the Los Angeles Police Department responded with a PR-24, which is a side handle baton, basically a piece of hard plastic or wood. And they repeatedly struck him. Every time he failed to follow their commands, they hit him one more time. And a lot of people look at that and they say, okay, the officers were horrible, and there's no question they were. I'm not here to say that they were acted appropriately. But there was actually a sergeant, a supervisor, on the scene that in essence condoned that behavior because it's their responsibility. My expectation of all my sergeants is that they are out there to be in charge. And if things are going the wrong direction, they need to say, hey, wait a minute, pull this back. But more importantly, the interesting thing is several years prior to this incident, the LAPD and law enforcement agencies across the country had used the chokehold, right? And that's where you take your arm, wrap it around somebody's neck, and you squeeze really tight, you cut off the blood supply to their brain, and they eventually pass out. And it works very well. Very dangerous technique, but it works. And so they had some problems with that. Some people died while in police custody, while the chokehold was being applied. And so the Los Angeles Police Department and agencies across the country said, you can no longer use this. That's about the time that side-handle batons and all these different sort of police tools came into play. And so the decision was made that we're not going to have any hands-on contact with people. Right? We're going to use this brand new tool. And so when you train your officers that you use a tool, a weapon, to gain compliance, right? You don't engage in a physical confrontation. So when somebody tells you, put your hands up, and you don't put your hands up, what is the response that you've trained your officers to do? Strike somebody with the tool, right? If they're on the ground, you roll over, they don't roll over, well, you don't jump on and do anything else, you strike them with the tool until you gain compliance. You can see how impractical that is when you talk about the use of force. But that's the thing that is so important that I really want to impress upon you. Because as I said before, I have 450 police officers that work for me. I have about 250 civilians and volunteers that work for me. And that is a large number of people out there doing all kinds of different things. And in fact, a good portion of those people carry guns all the time. And we can interject bias, we being police administrators, simply by the direction that we give. So let me ask you a question. If I were to tell my police officers that registration violations are a significant problem in the city of Salt Lake, those are vehicle registration, right? And I want you to stop everybody that has expired registration because they get in crashes more often, they don't have proper insurance and all those other things, so it's a significant problem. Where are my officers going to make those traffic stops? What's that?
On the road.
Okay, they will be on the road, but in as far as specific area of town.
West side.
West side. Absolutely. Not because it's a racial issue, because it's an economic issue. Right? And for two reasons, it becomes very complicated. One is, our state refuses to publish driver information in any language other than English. Well, we have a lot of non-English speakers that live in Salt Lake City. So one, they don't understand the law, and there's plenty of criminals that are willing to take advantage of people who do not understand the law. Right? You can go buy a registration sticker for $100, an improper registration sticker. But if you don't speak the language and it's not published in your language, somebody tells you, well, this is what you do. This is how you get your car registered. Or they sell you a car. Oh, you don't need to get registered. You can use these plates. For an extra $50, I'll put these plates on the car and it's yours and you're fine. Don't worry about it. Well, if you don't understand that, you go down the road thinking that's the right thing to do. All right? Along comes the police officer. Run the tags, oftentimes they're stolen. Right? So what do you get? You don't get an officer that knocks on the window, hi, is this a stolen car? Right? No, you get an officer that turns on their lights and sirens, pulls the car over. Right? We point guns at people who steal cars because it's a safety issue. Make them get out of the car, lie in the roadway. It becomes a big deal. And then we sort it all out and we find out, okay, it's not a stolen car, just the plates are stolen. So somebody may potentially go to jail. But even at the bare minimum, the car is going to the impound lot. So now you have a person who's purchased a car with the idea that they'll be able to pick the kids up from school, go to work, go to the grocery store, do what they need to do, and contribute to society. And a police officer has now gotten in the way of them being able to accomplish that mission. Because we take their car and hand them a piece of paper and say, okay, you now need to come pay all the registration fees, which in some cases may be years overdue, before you can have your car back. And when that amounts to $500, $600, $700, chances are pretty good they're never going to get their car out. And so, by giving that direction, right, I've sent officers out and I've interjected a little bit of bias. Because are they stopping white males who look like me? No, because by and large, from an economic issue, their standpoint, right, I speak the language, I have higher income, and so my exposure to that risk is very minimal. But for our minority communities, who again, English is a second language, don't have the money and the resources that they do in other areas. So now all of a sudden, I've now interjected racial bias into the direction that I've given my officers, not intentionally by any means, but by simply saying, we're going to force registration violations. So the ability for police, the responsibility that comes with administrative policing is significant. So going back to the Rodney King example, you never heard the Los Angeles Police Department Administration stand up and say, this is how we taught officers and we think this is, other than they condoned their behavior. And so it became a problem, right? It became a significant problem that resulted in rioting. A lot of negative impact on policing. In fact, it changed policing forever. But it also changed policing forever in a very positive direction. Because what it did is it, until that point, right, we had very intentionally put police officers in cars, removed them from interaction. Because if you remember the old days, and old days long before my time, but early parts of this country, policing was a very personal issue. The notion of the officer walking the beat, who everybody knew, he twirled his baton, shook hands, waved at people, right, threw the drunks out, and that was his job. But what happened was is we started to get a little too familiar. And so you had corruption that came in. And so with the advent of fast cars, radio systems that you no longer had to talk to people, right, a dispatcher, call us and we'll come help you. So we removed officers from that. And in fact, we moved into the era of just the facts, ma'am. Dragnet again. I'm looking at my audience here. I don't know how many of you remember Dragnet. TV show, a Los Angeles police detective, and all he wanted to know was the facts. Didn't want to get personal with anything, right? Because that's what we were all about. And we in society trusted that and said, we don't have any problem with that. Police officers, you know best. You tell us what to do, when to do, and we say yes. And policing was very good at that. That's when we became very paramilitary. Right? The whole persona of the police officer, the large person that comes and takes care of business, really took on a whole new meaning at that time. It wasn't friendly. Right? It was intimidating. Post-Rodney King and some other incidents that occurred across the country involving police officers, the public started to say, hey, wait a minute, we don't like this. We want to have input. We want to have say in what takes place in policing. You started to see civilian review boards, right? The public coming in and telling me what to do? That's unheard of, right? How does anyone in the public, how do any of you know what's right for policing in Salt Lake City? I've been doing it for 22 years. Who are you to tell me? And that was the attitude of a lot of police agencies, a lot of police administrators. But it's really just the opposite. Because as we allow the public to participate, as we do things like Mobile Neighborhood Watch, as we civilian review boards, public speaking opportunities, and those types of things, the public starts to develop trust. But more importantly, besides the trust, they start to have input into how things work. And when you allow somebody to have input and participate, they are now vested in what the outcome is. Right? I can easily stand up here and say, okay, class is dismissed, everyone leave. Some of you be happy, some of you be upset. But you kind of follow because that's what we're doing. Right? But when I say, okay, how do we want to handle this class? You can now make the decision as a body. You're now vested in that decision. Right? You are responsible for that. So as crime goes up, and I'll tell you what, I won't stand here and say that number of police officers has anything to do with the crime level in the United States, because I do not believe it does. In fact, last year we had 40,000 police officers out of work in the United States. Those are 40,000 police positions that existed the year before and were not last year in the United States. And crime has continued to decline across the country. We will never have enough police officers to stand on every street corner and prevent crime from occurring. And nor should that ever be our goal. Because we have more than enough citizens. There's more than enough people to participate and say, do you know what? We're not willing to allow that to go on in society. In fact, we're so unwilling to allow that type of behavior to occur that we're going to work with the police and we are going to solve the problem collectively. Because if we're just responding after the fact, right, at the point that society says, well, it's not happening to me, so I'm not going to worry about it too much, well, that's when criminals thrive. Where do you buy drugs in Salt Lake City? We'll test this class out.
The homeless shelter.
Okay, there we go. You and I are going to have to talk afterward. Fred, take your name down.
Down there, unfortunately.
Absolutely, down in the Pioneer Park area of Salt Lake City, down by the homeless shelter. Is that because it's a lovely place to sell drugs? Nice park, very convenient? Absolutely not. is because we in society have said, okay, that's where the homeless people are, and we really don't want to know and be involved in that, and so we're going to tolerate those people sitting around the park and doing all those types of things. And so as a drug dealer, what better place to go than, one, people who need my product, two, people, homeless folks primarily, who have issues with the police because the police are involved in citing them, arresting them for narcotics violations, for alcohol violations, for trespassing, all those other things. It's not fun to be involved in the police if you're with the police, if you're a homeless person in Salt Lake trying to make a living, because the police are always kind of getting in your business. Somebody's always calling. So when they don't have trust of the police, right, and the drug dealers come in and say, okay, you now hold my money, because if the police stop me, I don't want them to get all my money. And you over here, you hold my drugs. And if you take any of my drugs, well, I'm going to take you out back and take care of business. And they don't call the police and they don't participate. So you create a whole segment of society that is unwilling to participate. And what happens? Well, crime thrives. Right? What better place to be a drug dealer? But if you think about it, right, you put that same drug dealer, you take him out of Pioneer Park or out of the streets in and around the homeless shelter, you put him in the avenues, how many phone calls do you think I get? Lots of them, right? And it wouldn't take 5 minutes. So the participation is important. And in fact, that is why I believe crime is declining, even in light of hard economic crisis and everything else. Because I think there is more people invested. There's more people willing to participate with the police. The other thing that I think is extremely important is the fact that in policing, right, mid-90s, early 90s, really cool term came up, and it was that everyone had to do community-oriented policing. In fact, there's still an office of the federal government called the Community-Oriented Policing Office. And what we did is we said, okay, you five police officers, you're the friendly police officers. If you had a large agency, you did 10 or 12. You go out and be nice to the community. You talk to them and listen and everything else. The rest of us will still continue to do business the way we always have, but you're the nice people. And so we sent them out into the community. Well, the problem was is they really didn't solve the problems. We did a lot of listening, but we didn't do a lot of problem solving. And I think the important thing that has transitioned over the last 10, 15 years is that we in law enforcement have moved from the idea that only certain officers are community-oriented police officers, only certain officers participate, to where everybody participates. The expectation is that every single officer should be that friendly officer, that the goal is not simply to respond to crime, because if we're responding, right, the problem is a crime's already occurred. We have a victim in society. We want to prevent crime from occurring, and there is absolutely no way that I can prevent crime from occurring, especially those very personal crimes, as you aggravated assault, homicide, rape. Right? How do I, as a police officer, interject myself into that? But the public can. Right? Awareness. Right? Standing up and saying, hey, we're not going to tolerate this. The gang issue in the early 90s, mid-90s, was driven by the media. Think of how we glorified that lifestyle. I spent 5 years doing gang enforcement in Salt Lake City. And it was very difficult to make that determination of who was the hardcore gang member causing all kinds of problems and who was just the dressed like wannabe kind of person. Because that's what we saw on TV. That's what you saw on the 10 o'clock news. It became a big thing. Well, gangs haven't gone away. But what they've decided is, if we cause all kinds of problems, do drive-by shootings, have loud parties, wear a lot of colors and those types of things, well, the police get in our business. And we really want to be a criminal enterprise, sell lots of narcotics and participate in other criminal activities, and if we're more quiet about it, we can do a better job. And so you've seen that model kind of change. But a lot of what we do is driven by the media, the public opinion. Think about what comes on the 10 o'clock news all the time. Most of the time it is the homicides. And I'm not minimizing any of those crimes because those are very significant crimes. They're very personal crimes and they have large impact. By comparison, right, the number of fraud, theft, and abuses that take place on the internet, which we don't have near enough resources to cover, the difference is astronomical. Especially if you look from a cost basis. But that doesn't make the news. Right? In fact, if I ask what the biggest crime problem is, most people never touch on the fraud that takes place because it's not the 10 o'clock news. How many of you had your ID stolen? Big issue, right? That amounts in some cases to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, most robberies occur anywhere between a couple hundred bucks to $1,000. Most fraud cases, especially identity theft sort of thing, are in the tens of thousands of dollars at a minimum. But we don't stand up and say, hey, we're not going to tolerate this. We allow the media to kind of, and I'm not vilifying the media by any means, but I'm just saying the popular opinion drives a lot of those things. Okay, I've talked for a long time. Let's take some questions. What about policing? Do you want to know? Please.
You spoke earlier that police were the number one before the Army and all of that, the National Guard. Hurricane Sandy, you could see a rise, increase in violence, but you could also see the LAPD there during that emergency. The Salt Lake officers have that kind of plan ready?
Yes, certainly not for a hurricane,
but
we do a lot for earthquakes. Yeah, in fact, most of what's driven our new building that we're building, and it should be complete in June of this next year, is from an earthquake standpoint, so that we can be functional, right, in the event of a disaster like that happens. We disperse all our cars, right, throughout the valley. If you remember Katrina down in New Orleans, right, most of the New Orleans PD cars were all in the lots, you know, the city shops, and when the floodwaters came, all the motorcycles and cars were unavailable. So we actually send our cars out with our police officers. They take them home at night. And so I have officers that would respond from all different places, even if Salt Lake City were inaccessible itself. So we have a lot of plans in place. In fact, we just did a statewide earthquake disaster drill first part of the summer. So we do spend a lot of time and resources in doing that and coordinating those types of things.
One more question. Growing up in the Hispanic community, there was a big taboo, I guess you can say, about police officers. They were not to be trusted, not to be talked to. However, going to school, where in a predominantly white community, it was like always officers friendly and all that. I still feel like that taboo is still there.
Unfortunately, absolutely.
How are officers doing to change that taboo? What's been doing to change?
Not enough when you look across the country as a whole. So as I talked about the homeless population, right, and what we've created is a segment of our society, in that particular example, our homeless population, that mistrusts. And so what we see is crime and criminal activity rise. Same thing's going on with Hispanics primarily, right? Our Latino population, as the immigration debate has heated up, right? And the notion is we're going to put laws in place and we're going to have police officers go out and arrest all these criminals and make sure that they're not committing criminal violations. Well, so you understand, being undocumented in the state of Utah is not a crime. It is only a civil penalty. Very similar to tax law. Right? We don't send officers out, hey, did you fill out your 1099 correctly this year? And if you didn't, take you to jail. Right? You cannot be jailed. You cannot be fined. You can simply be detained and deported. So it's not a criminal act. We don't, as local law enforcement, become involved in civil violations of law. In fact, we shun away from them. Right? Because that is not our role. Our role is to look at criminal activity. There's been lots of studies done, right? The idea that Latinos, and especially undocumented individuals in the United States, commit crime at a higher rate is untrue, right? The RAND Institute has done some good studies. I sponsored a study here that I participated in with Salt Lake City, and it showed that, in fact, our undocumented community undercommits crime. Because they don't want to be involved in this. So this notion that we have all these criminals out here committing violations and stealing identification, well, that's not true. In fact, identity theft is one of the biggest misperceptions that minority communities are responsible for all the identity theft because they need to have identity in order to be in the country legally. Well, that's not true, right? They end up occupying a lot, but it's because some white guy, right, enterprising citizen, says, I can sell all these fake IDs to these poor people who have no idea what they're doing and have a mistrust of law enforcement, the government, and everything else, so I can take advantage of them. And so they steal the IDs. They, in turn, sell it to all these people saying, this is the right thing to do, this is proper and appropriate, and they don't have any idea. So this is something that we, as local law enforcement, should not be involved in. two goals that I had when I became the chief of police and continue to this day and will to the day I die. One is I want to humanize my police officers because we did a very poor job of that in the past. It was all about intimidation, as I said before, and the persona that existed. Right? My officers are family people. My officers have money issues. My officers have suicide issues. My officers, and I'm not minimizing who they are or anything else. They're people. Right? We are a microcosm of society. I don't go out and hire police officers from some distant island that they're all perfect and... Right? We are from society. And so we reflect the society that we are. And we're human. And the most important thing is to be able to empathize. Right? And when we forget that, we're not effective in our job. The second is to ensure that every single person who has contact with the Salt Lake City police officer is treated fairly. Right? And equitably. The same as anyone else. And you think, oh, that's very easy. But it's not. It's extremely difficult. Especially as laws come in place. And that's really why I've been such an outspoken opponent of some of the immigration laws that are proposed and have been enacted in some cases. Because it is not the role of local law enforcement. Because what happens is, think about this. In Salt Lake City, right, the census last year came out and said about a little less than 25% of our population is Latino. You go to the school census, and it says it's about 33% of the population in Salt Lake City. Do you know we have schools in Salt Lake City that are 90% minority population? 90% in a school. Right? People don't realize that's what Salt Lake City looks like. But why, as a police chief, or as a government official, or anyone else, would I want to alienate either 25%, a third of my population, or maybe even as high as 60, 70% of my population, that I have people that have a mistrust? And how can we make a determination? So, can I have you stand up, sir? I'm picking on you. I want you to stand. I need you to stand up. Stand up here. All right. So we're all the police officers. We're driving down the street, and we see these individuals on the street. Who are we going to ask if they're citizens of the United States? Yeah, that guy's really suspicious, isn't he, right? He is the one that I'm going to ask for sure. Absolutely not. And why am I not going to ask him that?
The North Face shirt.
The North Face shirt, yeah. Right, of course I'm not going to ask him that question. Now, we can certainly move to the idea that everybody is going to get asked the question. So no matter who you are, you have to carry ID and prove that you're a citizen of the United States. Tell you what, that's not what the United States is about for me. That's absolutely wrong. In fact, there's not a law in this state that says you need to carry ID unless you're operating a motor vehicle. So now I start making these, so the laws go into effect and say, okay, we gotta stop this horrible thing from occurring. So we want police officers to take action. Well, so immediately I look, okay, sit down, I'm not asking him anything. Right? Maybe he's Canadian, but who knows? Right? So now, what's the indicator of criminal behavior here? Is the color of your skin an indicator that you've committed some sort of criminal act? Yes, no? Got to go out on a limb here. Somebody have to say something. Okay, Sarah, what's your name? What's your last name? Okay, so now she gives me her ID, and I see that. Well, I know she's not, because she could almost pass, right? But because of her name, I'm now going to take different enforcement action than I did with the poor guy in the North Face shirt. Or in this case, the lucky guy who just said, hey, get out of here. Right? All right, you can have a seat, Sarah. What's your name? Where are you from?
Salt Lake City.
Okay. He's from Salt Lake City. Are you a citizen? Are you sure? Can you prove it?
Yes.
Let me see. No, I'm serious. Can you prove it? What do you have on your person right now that can prove you're a citizen of the United States?
I don't have my Social Security. Yeah, I thought I did.
Okay, so he needs to go to jail, right? Because he might be this horrible person who's committing a crime in the United States. Not having anything to do with what he's doing, right? Simply what he looks like. Sit down. Where are you from?
Born and raised here in Salt Lake.
Oh, my heavens. How do I know that? So are you a citizen of this country? Well, you obviously have some ID that can prove you're a citizen of this country, right?
Yeah.
Let me see it. That does not count. How many of you have tried to get a driver's license lately? You can't take your old driver's license in and say this is a good thing. In fact, you can't even take a U.S. passport in and say this is legit. You have to prove otherwise that you're a citizen. That's a very scary thing. It causes us to interject bias. Right? What is racial profiling? Who can give me a definition of racial profiling? Please.
Where you pick certain people out based on their color or race?
Okay, absolutely. So officers take enforcement action based on skin color or race, ethnicity. Is that right?
No.
Thank you. Who said that? Yeah, absolutely. It is not right. Is profiling okay? Profiling is good police work. Profiling for criminal behavior. And it's a very subtle difference, and that's why it's so difficult to detect when people do things inappropriately. Right? What criminal profiling is I say, okay, what's your name? Stand up for a minute. So I come up to him, I hand him a $20 bill. He hands me a small little white thing in my hand. I take it, tuck it in my pocket, we walk away, and that's the length of our interaction. What just occurred there? Absolutely. How do we know that? We can articulate, right? There was some behavior that took place. So what am I doing when I come up and say, excuse me, sir, are you dealing narcotics in Salt Lake City now?
Want me to say no?
I don't know, are you? No, have a seat. So I am now profiling for what I know is criminal conduct and behavior. Right? Profiling for what I can articulate as behavior is appropriate. And in fact, that's how laws are enforced, criminal laws in the United States. Profiling for race and ethnicity and those other things is absolutely wrong. In fact, it's counterintuitive to being effective. And it's a mistake that we've made in this country time and time again. What does a terrorist look like? Come on, you've seen TV. What does a terrorist look like, please? A turban, right, and a beard. So now think about this. If I'm going to go commit a terrorist activity, right, or engage in that, am I going to grow my beard out and wear a turban? Absolutely not. And if I walk to the airport, people start looking, don't they? Well, that's silliness. Right? And the mistake that we've made is to say that that is an important evaluation of what somebody is, what they look like, or what their activity may be. Because that does not indicate criminal behavior at all. And in fact, all we've done when we engage in that type of activity is we have alienated all the people who fit into that category, who may be good citizens in the United States participating, or not even citizens, but good people that are just participating in the world. And in fact, are those not the people that we want to have contact with? Because, right, if it has some religious motivation, if it has some of those other things, wouldn't I be more effective to hear from the community that knows who they are, that participates with them in all kinds of different activities, for them to come forward to the police and say, hey, you know what? Joe over here's got some problems. Same thing goes on. I mean, no matter where you look, Hispanic community, right? Imagine I had a young lady come up to me one time I spoke at the University of Utah, tears down her face, and said, will you talk to my mother? Absolutely, I'll talk to your mother. What do you want me to talk to your mother about? She said, well, I was brought here when I was 6 years old. And I'm going to school, and my mom doesn't want me to go to school because she's afraid the police will stop me and deport me because I'm not a citizen. So she's lived in this country since she was 6 years old, and her mother has a fear that the police will grab her daughter and take her away. In fact, the fear is so strong, and she was very successful up here at the University of Utah, that she didn't want her daughter to go to school and be successful. It's absolutely wrong. That's not what is America for me. That's not what policing is for me. Right? I should be ensuring that that young lady is safe and protected on her way to school, that the police are not the enemies. And that's why it's so important to stand up and say, because you know what? That young lady may be the one that when somebody tries to take advantage of her because she doesn't have documentation, right? And they try and sell her ID or something like that, she comes forward and says, hey, you know what? This place is engaging in criminal activity. But without her help, without her cooperation, if she doesn't have the trust of policing, well, then we fail. And when we look, right, as I stood those people up, they were citizens. Should they have to prove their identification and their citizenship any more than I would? Absolutely not. Right? That's wrong. That's biased policing. Right? And it's so much more than racial profiling. We in this country, when racial profiling has always been an issue, but when it kind of hit the hotbed, it's probably been 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more in this state. Came to all police agencies and said, you will collect all the information about those people that you stop. What do they look like? And so we said, all right, police officers, you stop 25% Latino. Well, you're okay because 25% of the population is that. You stop 4% Polynesian, we're good with that. We don't have any problem. Well, that doesn't really address the problem. Right? Because the problem is so much more subtle than that. So think of my three people that I had standing up. Who do I write a ticket to? I stop them all for the same violation. Do I have to write them a ticket? No. My officers have the discretion and ability to do or to not write a ticket. So if I write everybody that looks like Sarah, am I biased? Or if I don't write anybody that looks like that, but I stop everybody that fits that description. How many people do I ask to search? So I stand the same four people up, right? And I ask, I'm sorry, remind me of your name. Sony, can I search you? You don't have any drugs on you, do you? Stand up here. You don't mind if I search you for drugs, do you? No, because you're a good guy, aren't you? So that's fine. Can he say no to me? Does he know he can say no? I don't know. He's an educated man. He's up here at the university. But put that in a street encounter. How many people understand their rights? In fact, that is one of the most interesting things when I worked a lot of narcotics in the past time in my career. Because there's a lot of people that you walk up to and they're holding drugs in their pocket. And you say, may I search you for drugs? And they say, yes. Because they think if they say no to you, then that's suspicion and then you'll search them anyway. So they say yes, thinking, oh, they, you know, let me go. So you get in their pocket and you pull out a big baggie of dope. And you say, oh, guess what? You're going to jail. You put the handcuffs on them, you take them to jail, you go to court, and you say, Your Honor, I swear. Right? And it, very innocently, I'm not making light of this at all. I asked the man if it was all right to search him, and he said yes, and he had dope in his pocket. And the judge says, well, why would anybody who has a baggie full of dope ever tell the cops that they can search him? Let them in their car. Search their home. Right? Education is important. Don't we want a society that is well-educated, that understands the laws, that understands their rights, that participates in society as opposed to alienating segments of our society? And that's what we have done when it comes to immigration issues, when it comes to terrorist issues. We have made the mistake of alienating a good segment of our society. And when I say we, it's policing very effectively. We've done a poor job. Everybody should be comfortable coming forward and telling me about criminal activity or what problems are. Right? And when we don't, criminal activity thrives. Please.
My name's Dan Adams, and I was wondering how much of your police officers, how many of your police officers speak Spanish? And if they do, is it easier to get a job if you speak Spanish?
It helps. It helps. So, a good portion. I'm very fortunate. I have a lot of officers that speak a lot of different languages, not just Spanish. And again, microcosm of society. I do hire a lot of return missionaries. And so they speak a lot of languages. And it's very nice for policing because very rarely... we have language lines and different things that you can call and get interpreters. Very rarely do I not have the ability to have an officer show up and speak the language, which makes a big difference. It's a civil service process to get hired on, so your language skills don't help you till you get further along in the process because you kind of have to pass the hurdle exams and things. But it certainly is an advantage. The number one thing that I hire police officers for nowadays is their ability to articulate and empathize. Every single candidate to come work for me sits in my office at some point before I hire them. And I don't hire all of them. I send a lot away. One, I want them to know what my expectations are. Right? I think that's important because I hold officers to an extremely high standard. In fact, a standard that's unfair because you all can do things that one of my police officers cannot. They have to be that much above the people that we can never be the person engaging in criminal activity, the person who has a loud party at their house all the time. Because once you become a police officer, everybody knows. It's hard to hide. All the neighbors know. And so you have to set the standard. Right, being a police officer doesn't mean that you get to speed down the street because you know all the cops and they're not going to write you a ticket. Being a police officer means that you don't speed, so everyone who knows that you're a cop knows, okay, he follows the law and he's an individual character. So it is one of those things. And then I want to hear their ability to articulate and to empathize. I ask them hard questions. And more often than not, the number one thing that I don't kick them out of my office, but the reason I don't hire them once they get to me is because they don't articulate. You have to be able to talk. That's the most important thing. You can escalate any situation, right? I almost guarantee after 22 years that there's not a person in this room that I can't upset enough to scream and yell at me or take a swing at me by just how I treat them. Right? That's unethical behavior. But you learn to manipulate people. That's what you deal with all day long, is people in crisis. And people in crisis are not thinking. And so if you want to escalate the problem and turn everything into a fight, well, it's very easy to do. But that's not the purpose of policing. Right? Everything we should do. When the police show up, the situation should get better. If it gets worse, we have a problem. Question, please.
So another with the Army, you have a lot of disqualifiers like asthma and allergies. Do you have similar disqualifiers in the police force?
We do have some. We are not as strict necessarily as the Army. Basically, asthma, if a doctor will say you're okay to participate, then we don't have any problem. Eyesight is an issue for us. It just has to be corrected eyesight because you have to just be, you know, have to be able to shoot and see the target and some of those other things, identify things. So there are some little ones, but not big ones. Drug use is a big thing. Integrity issues are a big thing. And the number one thing for me and my officers know it. If you lie, right, whether in the process, right, to the supervisor or anything else, in internal affairs when you're asked a question, or quarter a document, you won't work for me. Absolutely not. And I don't give anyone a second chance on that. Because how can you ever put a police officer in a stand and say, I swear to what I'm about to tell you, when they've, in the past, not had personal integrity? And so otherwise, there's a lot, I mean, we make mistakes. There's no question about it. We ask our officers to go out and deal with situations in a split second. In fact, no one else in society do we give this kind of trust to. In fact, I could put handcuffs on this young lady, have Fred escort her out to the car, and nobody's going to ask me a question. I don't even need to have a reason. Take her and book her in the jail. Now, eventually, it's going to catch up to me because the judge is going to review my probable cause and all those other things. But the fact is, I can take away her freedom right now. And there's no review. Right? There's nobody that's going to second guess me. It's a lot of authority and responsibility. In fact, my police officers, right, are out on the street. They don't call me up in the middle of the night and say, hey, chief, I'm in a bad situation. I might have to shoot my gun and kill this individual. Are you okay with it? Right? I mean, it's silly. It's nonsense. So we afford, or we allow police officers to carry some authority that is significant. And so it's always been my opinion that it's our responsibility as police officers and administrators to make sure that we live up to that high standard and the trust and commitment that the community gives us. So it's a big deal. There's two things that I have complete control over. Other than that, there's very little when you're the police chief, because a lot of things happen. One is who gets hired, because the final say, I always get to say whether or not you get hired. And they can't, you know, the way the rules are set up, I can say, no, you're not hired. And two, who I get to promote. And so those are two things I take very seriously and some of the hardest decisions that I have. Because, again, I want the very best individual because they represent me personally. And I'm proud to have them do that. And like I say, we make mistakes, and I stand up and apologize sometimes. And I discipline and fire people sometimes. And that's not the best part of my job. But accountability is important. Accountability is very important. Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, please, I'm sorry. You're all set up. Oh, we'll come. I'll get you.
Thank you for coming today, sir. My name is Ashley Jolin, and I'm a political science and English major. I wanted to ask you, can you go deeper into the relationship of our police force with the Utah State Legislature? I know there's the committee that's assigned to like law enforcement, but when it comes to influencing bills or supporting bills, how much do they respect your input in bills?
Tim, don't laugh at me.
So, yeah, that's my question. Thank you.
My job is to influence the legislature, and both at a national and local level, right? Because I believe it's the responsibility of law enforcement to say these are good ideas or these are bad ideas. And so I spend a great deal of time involved in that. And I certainly have relationship. I have been extremely outspoken. I have testified in front of Congress 4 times on immigration and civil rights issues. And I, again, my responsibility to go back and tell the United States Congress this is how I feel about laws. This is how it affects local law enforcement and how things should be. So I do a lot of that. And you know, I spend a lot of time in trying to develop relationships and everything else. Not always do they listen. It's very much an adversarial role at times. My personal philosophy on life and being the police chief, if I am doing my job in order to make sure I have my job tomorrow, then I'm not doing a very good job. I need to make decisions that I believe to be right for the police department and the public that we serve. And sometimes those are not always what would be viewed as the most politically correct ideas. But again, that's how I'm able to sleep at night, is I look and say, is this the right thing to do? And if it is, I mean, it's so important for me that my children, my family members, my friends that I care about, and the public that I serve know that I'm willing to stand up and say this is the right thing to do. And so that's how I view things. And so sometimes I, you know, the relationship at the legislature can be a little rocky. I've certainly had a lot of opposition towards any idea or notion to make local law enforcement be involved in immigration issues. It's not what we should do. I'm very outspoken on some of the terrorist issues and those types of things. I think we can do a better job. Our job should always be to be inclusive of people. Right? And there's different, everybody has different roles. I realize that, and ideas. But local law enforcement should be there equally for everybody. And if we're not, then we're not doing our job and we're not effective. In fact, we're counterproductive to the well-being of society if we don't have trust and confidence. Other, back here, and then I'll... Go ahead.
My name is Kyle Perkins, and you mentioned one of your main goals as the chief of police is to humanize the police force. What are some things, some specific things that you have done or that you require your police officers to do in order to accomplish that?
Good question, because that is a really hard thing. Like I said, I have about 700 employees and volunteers that work for me, and so to influence that many people is very difficult. But one, I feel I need to set the example. Right? It's important for everyone to know that the police chief does what he says. That's why I go out and speak a lot. That's why I wear a uniform all the time. I'm very proud to wear a uniform. Right? And not because I'm the chief of police and get to wear all the costume jewelry. Because I took a lot of pride in the job when I got the job, and it was one I fell into. I didn't grow up wanting to be a police officer or anything else. This was just something that came along. But it's important that people view me. So I show up at all kinds of different events. There was a mention made of the ACLU award that I received. That means a great deal to me. Because how many places in the country does the ACLU give a police chief an award? In fact, most of the time, we're at odds. In fact, I'm sure there's some people who turned in their membership card to the ACLU, but that meant a great deal to me. Because those are the groups, the organizations, right, that make us better. The people who are, watchdog is a bad word, but it's just like another award I'm very proud of. The Defense Bar gave me an award, a recognition. I don't view the Defense Bar as the adversary to the police department. In fact, I invite them in to participate with the police, in to train new recruits, to teach in-service training. Because we're there to make sure that we do things right, that we protect people's civil rights. And if we're not, right, if there's problems and issues, well, we're not doing our job correctly. Right? And that's where we get lost a little bit. Right? Our number one job is not to catch criminals and put them in jail. The number one goal should always be to prevent crime from occurring in the first place. And that is not always putting people in jail. In fact, we've incarcerated people in this country for how many years at the highest rate of anywhere in the world, and we haven't been effective. Right? We have not solved that problem by incarcerating all those people. And so we need to do a better job. I've changed for promotion. Right? It used to be that they took tests and everything else. I got a list of candidates for sergeant. And then the chief would pick off the list of who was appropriate to be promoted. Well, I now take the top 8 people on my list, and I make them go work in an assignment where they are the liaison to the community council districts in Salt Lake City. Not just to go and smile and shake hands, but to identify what the problems are, come back to the police department, and task the resources of the police department to make sure that we solve those community problems. And that's what they're measured on. And so I have officers that are not sergeants because the community has come forward and said, hey, we're not real fond of how that's working. And so you need to follow through with some of these things and make sure you're consistent. And so you send the message that it matters and it's important. And you stand up. Again, you have to stand up. And so the times that laws are enacted or proposed are not the times for me to hide my head and hope I keep my job. Those are the times to stand up and say, no, absolutely not, we're not going to do that. And again, that's much more important, I think, than maintaining a position.
My name is Sonny Kinney, and I'm from a community that we're the Salt Lake City Police Department is very familiar with. And I was just wondering if you could define what the RICO Act, and is it enforced throughout the state or just in certain areas?
RICO statutes are, it's what the federal government used to work on the mob and organized crime a number of years ago. And that basically says when two or more people come together to commit crime with the purpose of committing criminal activity, to engage in a criminal enterprise, then they can all be held accountable for that. And so it is used, it is not used a whole bunch, I mean, because it's a high standard. It works very well for gang activity, and it has been. I mean, some of the Polynesian gangs that we've had, the Tongan Crip gang was one that RICO statute worked very well. And what it says, right, is so you have 10 people who get together to commit criminal activity. One person might be the one who commits the homicide, who actually pulls the trigger. Right? But you had somebody who drove the car. You had somebody else who planned it. You had somebody else who called the person on the phone and told them to come out to the front yard as you did the drive-by. All those people can be held accountable for those criminal acts. And it's very effective. And so it does. But it's one that we always need to be careful that we don't overuse it. I mean, it needs to be where appropriate. And where appropriate, I think, you know, when people get together, especially to engage in criminal activity. I think I've got time for one more. Oh, okay.
That's the conclusion of our online broadcast. So please thank Chief Burbank for an excellent informative forum.